thank you so much, everyone, for coming and having me here. I'm Surur, and I'll tell you today a bit about my work on scattering interactions between dark matter and standard model particles, specifically in the context of cosmology. So when we usually think about dark matter interacting with the standard model, and a classic example that comes to mind is that of the WIMP paradigm, or the idea that that dark matter can be a weakly interacting massive particle. And the reason it's a well-known example is because there are good theoretical motivations for us to try and search for this kind of dark matter. The first one being that it's a pretty simple extension of the standard model, and the other one being that if we try and calculate the relic abundance of dark matter in the universe today, the theoretical prediction from the WIMP matches what we observe. So this match in theory and observation is what we know as the WIMP miracle. However, there haven't been conclusive results that would indicate that dark matter is a WIMP-like particle. And so that has motivated people to go beyond the WIMP and try and search for other models. And this has inspired several search programs. For example, people can look for the excess in standard model particles coming from dark matter annihilating with itself, and that is indirect detection. Secondly, people can collide standard model particles and then see what comes out and see if we can produce dark matter in that way. And lastly, there's scattering, so direct detection, where, for example, in underground terrestrial experiments, we try and detect the recoil that would come about if a dark matter particle came and hit a standard model nucleus. And my work has mainly focused on signatures that arise from this channel of scattering. So that's what I'll mainly be focusing on today. So as I mentioned, an example of experiments that look for scattering signatures is direct detection experiments underground. And here I'm showing an example of constraints for dark matter and proton scattering as a function of dark matter mass. And this gray region here is one of the constraints that come from direct detection. And I'd just like to point out that there is a minimum mass that these experiments, their sensitivity, it goes down to some minimum mass of dark matter. And there's also a ceiling to the cross-section that occurs because of the shielding that is done for these experiments. So the strength of the interactions that these experiments can probe, there's a maximum limit to that. And what is nice about cosmology is that there are several probes, for example, the cosmic microwave background or the CMB large-scale structure, which can be probed through Lyman Alpha Forest, small-scale structure, which is probed through the Milky Way satellite distribution, and some other probes which are not on here. But we have a lot of options to look at parameter space, which is highly complementary to what direct detection experiments are doing. And moreover, for each of these probes, there are several experiments that are collecting very high precision data. And so my point being that we can now observe our universe to very high precision. And my goal as a theorist has been to try and find ways of keeping theoretical accuracy to be at par with this ever-growing observational precision. So I'll briefly go over a few quantities that are relevant to the cosmological framework of dark matter baryon scattering. And just to note that I'll be using the symbol chi for dark matter and b for baryons, which is to mean any massive standard model particle. That's just the terminology used in the literature. So cosmological observables are sensitive to energy and momentum that is exchanged between species in the early universe. So when dark matter scatters with baryons, it's going to change the heat and momentum content of the baryonic fluid as well. So what we care about includes the heat exchange rate, or Q chi dot, which is proportional to the rate of change of energy and averaged over the distribution function of dark matter velocities. And this is going to affect the dark matter temperature, which, since it is coupled to baryons, is going to affect the baryon temperature. And we also need the momentum exchange rate, V chi dot, which is, again, an averaged quantity, including the distribution function of dark matter velocities. And this is going to, again, affect the baryon momentum. And since baryons and photons are tightly coupled in the early universe, we expect effects of scattering, of dark matter baryon scattering, to get transmitted to, for instance, the cosmic microwave background. And lastly, I'll note that solving these equations generally would involve implementing the collisional Boltzmann equation, which is an integral differential equation. Okay, so with those ideas in mind, I'll go on to tell you about some of the work that I've done addressing some issues that arise in this theoretical framework. And the first issue that I have tried to address has to do with the fact that there's this blanket assumption that is made in the framework that the distribution function of dark matter velocities is thermalized or is Maxwell-Boltzmann. And this assumption is made regardless of whether dark matter is actually, the model that is being studied is actually able to scatter efficiently enough to thermalize. The second issue that I have worked on has to do with the fact that the dark matter baryon scattering rate is an intrinsically nonlinear quantity. And so that becomes a problem because the standard lambda CDM cosmology framework can only handle equations that are linear in perturbation variables. And we actually just submitted this yesterday, so hopefully you'll see it today on the archive. And I'll start by telling you about the first project. So let me say a bit about why this assumption is made so ubiquitously in the first place. And it helps us mostly by simplifying the mathematical complications that arise. So the heat and momentum exchange rates then have analytical forms. They're complex functions in terms of some hypergeometric functions, but they're analytical and we can handle them. And making this assumption also means that we no longer need to solve the full collisional Boltzmann equation, which is a huge simplification because as I've just for illustration purposes noted here that if you lift the Maxwell-Boltzmann assumption on the distribution function, this is the integral that we would have to implement, which is highly non-trivial. So when does this assumption become a problem? And that arises mostly on the physics side of this. Once we assume the distribution function to be Maxwell-Boltzmann, we're implicitly assuming that dark matter is perfectly efficiently scattering either with baryons at all times or with itself. And that is done even when it's not self-consistent with the model that is being studied. So just to illustrate here, as a preview, when we do actually implement the exact evolution of the distribution function, we see that there is significant, and that is the solid lines, we see significant deviation away from the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, which is the dotted curve over there. And lastly, but importantly, making this assumption excludes the study, excludes our ability to study models of dark matter which have interesting self-scattering properties, because the self-scattering collision operator is automatically set to zero in this scenario. Sorry, was there a question?
Yeah, maybe. So are you saying, you know, so in your plot here, like, the dotted curves were showing cold dark matter distribution functions. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not cold. It's what we would get if dark matter was interacting with baryons, but we are assuming that it has a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution.
Okay. Okay. But just like plain vanilla CDM, so if we measure the distribution function using n-body simulations, my impression was that it's pretty close to Maxwellian. So are you saying that, no, super CDM, that is not the case?
I'm not entirely sure about the level of precision of the simulation, like to what extent they match Maxwell-Boltzmann. I know that, I mean, CDM is of course a very good approximation. It's, these differences are, to my knowledge, going to be about a factor of two. So if we want to consider scattering, and take into account the exact scattering effects, then there will be slight deviations from, that is like considering deviations from cold dark matter, adding in scattering. So it would have to be within the limits that are set by data. It's not going to be something that's going to,
But I think this is in the early universe before collapse.
Like multi-way. You mean, okay, I see. You mean,
yeah, this is pre-recombination. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Should I move on?
Yeah, actually, I have a question. So, usually, Maxwell-Boltzmann is assumed because you assume, you know, some thermal production from standard model. But here,
standard what? Sorry?
Like the dark matter, if it's produced thermally from the standard model.
Yeah.
Then you expect some actual Boltzmann distribution when it freezes out or something. So what you're saying applies to what production mechanisms?
I'm not exactly sure about the work that I've done assumes a sort of model independent treatment, but these are fairly well motivated theoretical models where there's power law dependence on the relative velocity, and early on production can happen through different mechanisms like freezing, or there's quasi non-thermal production that is also considered. So there's a mix of models that can be analyzed in the class of models that we look at. So I'll say a bit more about what kinds of models we look at, but yeah, that's.
Yeah, may I ask, if you start from thermal distribution, if it's thermally produced and initially it's thermal, can it actually get out of thermal, can it have another way around it? That if you start from thermal distribution, basically the evolution drives it away from it. Would that be possible?
Yeah, that is sort of what we're seeing in this simplified analysis that I'll say a bit more about. When these particles are scattering early on, we assume that they start out thermalized with baryons. But as they scatter and the universe cools and they start to decouple, then you don't really know if this assumption anymore remains accurate, because there might not be as efficient scattering while they're decoupling. So then we expect the highest deviations to be around the decoupling redshift of these models.
Well, and you see it in your calculations.
I've removed numbers and stuff just for illustration here, but this is an exact in the background limit. What we did was this is the deviation that shows up
from thermal distribution.
From the thermal distribution at any time. So the darker curves are later times here. So it starts out Maxwell-Boltzmann, as you can see, the lighter curves approach the dotted curve, and then they start deviating over time. As the curves get darker, that is later time.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you.
Just to clarify for me, so in the standard approach you described, where people assume Maxwell-Boltzmann, what's assumed for the temperature for the dark matter species?
The temperature follows, so it starts out cold. Zero temperature initially. And in the standard one, it wouldn't get affected by the baryonic temperature. Once we add in scattering, there's going to be some heating into the dark matter temperature. but mostly it's considered like way less than baryonic temperature, grows slightly over time, and then it never goes above the CMB temperature.
Actually, why? Yeah, now I'm a bit confused. So why the temperature of dark matter would be lower, like significantly lower than baryons, if they are produced by freeze-out, by the standard kind of thermal freeze-out?
Yes, sorry. I might have mixed that up. You're right.
First, yeah, there are some...
The temperature would start out coupled because the baryons are scattering efficiently at early time. Baryons and dark matter are scattering efficiently at early time. And then as they decouple.
Yeah, that's right. And then it grows down, yes.
So you're showing that in the plot right there. They're slowing down a little bit relative to the thermal distribution.
Yeah, the velocities go lower, yeah.
Okay, cool, thanks so much.
Thank you for the question. Okay. So given some of the restrictions that I listed before, there has been work that's been done to find a less stringent approach, and that is the diffusion approximation or the Fokker-Planck formalism that was developed in Ali Hamoud 2019. And this approximation sets the full collision operator to be approximately equal to a diffusion operator. And it goes on to calculate the heat and momentum exchange rates more self-consistently compared to the Maxwell-Boltzmann method, in the sense that if you give the input a particular distribution function, the formalism is going to give you the exact heat and momentum exchange rates. But again, since it's an approximation in the collision operator, it might not evolve the distribution function exactly. But given a particular F chi, it's going to return exact heat and momentum exchange rates. So that's the that's what this formalism was made for. And physically, what it means to approximate scattering with diffusion is that we're assuming that the dark matter particle velocity doesn't change much on scattering. So the initial and final velocities are approximately the same. And this scenario would arise naturally if the dark matter particle was much more massive than the baryon. So we have a heavy billiard ball dark matter particle scattering with a light ping pong ball like baryon. The velocity of the dark matter particle is not going to change by a lot. So diffusion is a perfectly reasonable approximation to make in this mass regime. But we would like to know how this formalism performs outside of this mass limit. Specifically, if the dark matter and baryonic particles are comparable in mass, or if the dark matter is much lighter than the baryon, we would like to see how this formalism performs. And this is an interesting mass regime to probe, specifically for cosmology, because if you recall this plot of constraints that I had shown, the dark matter proton scattering cross-section and the dark matter mass. This is the proton mass at 1 GeV. And the mass regime that we're concerned about is where a lot of these probes are looking. So to gauge the accuracy of an approximation, we need exact results to be able to compare to. And that is what did not exist at the time. And so that's what I worked on. I worked on evolving the distribution function exactly in the background limit. And taking the smooth universe limit simplifies things, but it's still a non-trivial task to implement the integral differential equation. And there's a lot of math and manipulation that went into that, but I won't talk about that in the main part of the talk. I think the interpretation of the results are more interesting, but if people are not too bored by the end of my talk, I would be happy to talk about it more at that time. So in the background scenario, we calculate the background heat exchange rate, or Q chi dot, and use that as a metric to gauge the accuracy of the Fokker-Planck method, comparing it to exact results. So that's what I'm showing here, the fractional difference in the heating rates as a function of time, and for a range of mass ratios between the baryon and dark matter. This panel is comparing Fokker-Planck to the exact, and that one, Maxwell-Boltzmann to the exact. And what we're seeing is that the maximum deviation that the Fokker-Planck formalism exhibits from the exact is about 17%, in contrast to the 160% deviation that Maxwell-Boltzmann can exhibit. And what this is telling us is that across all mass regimes, even when we don't expect scattering to be physically diffusive, the Fokker-Planck formalism seems to be recovering the heat exchange rate quite well to within 20%, especially when we compare it to the Maxwell-Boltzmann results. So this bodes well, and it motivates trying to consider diffusion in scattering rather than assuming thermalization, even when we go beyond the background and take into account anisotropies, which is what is relevant for most cosmological observables. And this good recovery of the exact results was kind of surprising. We weren't sure what to expect. And it comes about because of the sort of self-consistent implementation of the Fokker-Planck formalism, where it gives you correct rates of heat exchange given a distribution function. So that seems to make a big difference. And another thing that we were not anticipating was that what we're seeing here is that in both the very massive dark matter limit and very light dark matter limit, the Fokker-Planck formalism seems to be getting close to exact results. So the maximum deviation is occurring for the comparable mass regime. And we hadn't expected that. To understand this, I'll say a bit about 3D diffusion versus 1D, and 3D being what is relevant for cosmological anisotropies. So 3D scattering is diffusive in 3D if the velocity vector of the dark matter particle doesn't change by much on scattering. In 1D, the constraint is less restricting in the sense that we only need the velocity magnitude of the dark matter particle to not change. So if dark matter is much lighter than the baryon, in this case, the dark matter particle is the ping pong ball, it comes and hits a heavy particle, it'll just bounce off with roughly the same speed. But the deflection in 3D can be pretty large. So in 1D, we do now understand why we're seeing this trend. But in 3D, we don't expect the Fokker-Planck formalism to work that well in this other mass extreme. So what can we say about my analysis then, since there's this significant qualitative difference in the light dark matter mass limit? So to address that, this is a plot showing diffusivity. It's a coefficient that indicates diffusivity. Below one, scattering is diffusive, and above one, scattering becomes non-diffusive. As a function of mass ratios between baryons and dark matter, the dashed curves are the 1D implementation or the background implementation, and they should match my analysis. The solid curves are the ones that are for 3D scattering. And the different colors are for different velocity dependence of the scattering cross-section. So if we look at the dashed curves for a moment, in both the heavy and light dark matter limit, scattering becomes increasingly diffusive. So Fokker-Planck should do well in 1D. But in the solid curves in 3D, we don't expect scattering to be diffusive when we get to the light-dark matter limit. So we don't expect the accuracy of the Fokker-Planck method that we're finding in 1D to transfer over to 3D when we include perturbations. But what I can say is the following, that in this intermediate mass limit, scattering is not only non-diffusive in 3D, it's also non-diffusive in 1D. But even in this non-diffusive regime, we are recovering the correct heat exchange rate to about 20%. And this is what is a good indicator for us to then involve incorporate Fokker-Planck into the 3D scenario as well. So to develop that formalism. So that sort of wraps up what I'll say about the first project. And I'll move on to the second one now, which has to do with the intrinsic non-linearity of the dark matter and baryon scattering rate. So if we look at the momentum equation for dark matter, there's going to be some standard terms that come in even when there's no dark matter baryon scattering. And once we take into account scattering, there's this momentum exchange term that now needs to be accounted for, where gamma v is the momentum exchange rate coefficient, which depends on the relative velocity, v chi b, and the relative thermal motion, which I'm going to denote by T over m chi b for short. And if we look at this entire term, it's manifestly nonlinear in the perturbation variables v chi and vb. So it doesn't fit in as is into the linear lambda CDM framework of equations that we have. So current methods sidestep this issue by using mean field ansatz, which I'll shorten as MFA. And this was proposed by Dworkin et al. In 2013. And what they propose is to replace the nonlinear original gamma v with gamma MFA, where the bulk velocity is set to zero, and the thermal motion is replaced by its sum with an effective bulk motion term. And it's important to note here that this expression is not derived, but it is well designed in the sense that it accomplishes the following two goals. Firstly, it gets rid of the nonlinearity that comes about due to weak IB. And secondly, if this bulk motion is much less than the thermal motion, the original, the full gamma V is going to approach this mean field ansatz. So here I'm showing the evolution of these two kinds of velocities, the blue curve being for bulk motion and the orange one for thermal motion as a function of redshift. And what we see is that at high redshift, like above 10 to the 4 or so, indeed the bulk motion, the blue curve is much lower than the orange one. So we should be fine to assume this mean field ansatz at these high redshifts. The problem arises that this is used even at lower redshift, when, as you will notice, the bulk motion not only becomes comparable to the thermal motion, it actually begins to dominate over it. And in that regime, the accuracy of this ansatz is unknown. In fact, its accuracy is most uncertain at the very redshift, which is extremely relevant to the CMB. So how does this uncertainty in the method affect different kinds of scattering models that are considered? Here, this is a plot showing scattering efficiency as a function of redshift. And the different curves are for different power law dependence of the cross-section on the relative velocities. So as I mentioned, at these high redshifts, we're fine to use the mean field ansatz, and the uncertainty comes about in this lower region. But there is another factor. If we have extremely low scattering efficiency, then effectively dark matter has decoupled from baryons and scattering is not going to affect observables as far as we're concerned. In that case, any gamma, any reasonable gamma, including the mean field ansatz, should be fine for us to use. So that leaves this blue region here, which is still uncertain. And the CMB is going to be sensitive to these models that are becoming more and more efficient at scattering as time goes on. So for example, the V to the minus 4 model, which is Coulomb-like dark matter or Millie-charged dark matter. And so, and also the CMB actually places some of the strongest bounds on this model in particular. So any uncertainty that we have in our theoretical methods is going to have the greatest implications for models like the Coulomb-like dark matter. So we wanted to try and find a more rigorous method. And we approached this problem in two ways that I think are different from what is usually seen in the literature. Instead of expanding in the perturbation variables themselves, we expand in the interaction cross-section, sigma chi b. So the anisotropies can be expanded into a standard zeroth order term in order in powers of sigma, which would be there even when we don't have any scattering, and a term that is linear, a contribution that is linear in sigma. So the power spectrum or the CLs are going to have a standard term and a delta CL contribution coming from scattering. And this delta CL to linear order in sigma is going to depend on this cross-correlation function between the zeroth order theta and theta 1. The second thing that we did was we didn't at first try to find a way to incorporate gamma into the equations of motion and get transfer functions. We sort of skipped a few steps in the sense that we try and analytically work out at first what this cross-correlation function looks like at the end. So in other words, how does this gamma, which is nonlinear, ultimately enter into this average that we need to calculate? And here we find something quite interesting, that this cross-correlation function would be exactly the same if we replaced this nonlinear gamma with this velocity-independent ratio, which we define as gamma tilde. So in other words, we can get the exact delta CL to linear order in sigma by simply replacing this complicated gamma with something that just involves its second moment. And this gamma tilde is perfectly calculable. So we went ahead and calculated it. And lo and behold, what we find is that this gamma tilde turns out to be exactly equal to the mean field ansatz that was proposed by Dworkin et al. In 2013. And to this, you might wonder, rightfully so, whether I took you through all of this simply to pat myself on the back because we figured out the math to physics that they had predicted or intuited 10 years ago, except that is not what I'm trying to do. The merit of our work lies in the following. Before, the method, the entire community that was studying these interactions, including Dworkin et al., were uncertain about the accuracy of the method that was being used in all of this parameter space. But now we have been able to say pretty rigorously when they are right and when they are not. So as long as we have interactions that are weak enough, so the response in CLs is linear in the cross section, we are good to use their mean field ansatz. However, in this region up here, where the scattering efficiency becomes quite high, the effect on the CLs is no longer going to be linear in sigma. And so now we know that we should not be using their ansatz in this regime. And here also, you might point out that really I've only added a proper method to this sliver of parameter space. I haven't said what we can use here. I've just said that we shouldn't be using what we have. And that's true. But this region of parameter space is, in some sense, the most interesting region, because back here at very high redshift, the models that are scattering efficiently up here, they affect smaller scales. And so the CMB is actually not the strongest probe that we have for these models. And down here, scattering doesn't, it's not doing anything interesting. So it is over here where this Coulomb-like dark matter, for example, is beginning to scatter more and more efficiently and will affect the CMB in ways that we would like to probe accurately. And so in the very highly efficient scattering regime, we can now be mindful of this fact that when we look at constraints like these, where the fraction of dark matter that is interacting can be varied, we know that as you go to lower and lower fractions of dark matter that's interacting with baryons, the data can allow larger and larger cross sections. And now we know that we have to be mindful about when these interactions become too strong. So when the response starts becoming nonlinear in sigma. So that was part of the analysis I did. On the y-axis is the ratio that should be one if the response in the CLs is linear in sigma as a function of the interacting fraction of dark matter. And what we're seeing is that only around when almost all of the dark matter is interacting with the baryons can we really trust this gamma MFA. As you go down to lower and lower fractions, the interaction becomes increasingly nonlinear, or the effect of the interactions becomes increasingly nonlinear in the CLs. So we really don't have a proper method to probe this region of parameter space. So that wraps up what I have done so far on this, but the scattering, the nonlinearity of this scattering term is interesting and can lead to other exploration that I think would be good to follow up on. And that is because noting that replacing the exact gamma V with gamma tilde doesn't give us the exact anisotropy, doesn't give us the exact theta, it only gives us the exact cross-correlation function. So the theta, the anisotropy is still nonlinear in velocities, which means it's nonlinear in the initial perturbation zeta, and that it can give rise to non-Gaussian signatures. For example, we anticipate having a four-point function that would arise from this nonlinearity. Sorry, how am I doing on time? Okay, thank you.
Why not three-point function?
So that is because this gamma V, for simplicity, I had changed this to V chi B, but it actually depends on V chi B squared. So it's the lowest order non-zero non-Gaussian contribution that you will get is going to be the four-point function. So just as an example of an estimate that we can do, Planck's sensitivity or the upper limits on the primordial four-point function is about 10 to the minus 4 of the average squared of zeta squared, whereas we can do a back of the envelope estimate for the trispectrum at linear order in sigma that would arise from scattering, and that comes out to be about 10 to the minus 2 times this average squared. If we assume that the interaction is saturating the current bounds that come from the power spectrum of the CMB. So this indicates that it's possible that we can have a large signal-to-noise ratio from the Pry spectrum, and it could have more constraining power than the power spectrum. And lastly, because of this nonlinearity, the curl of velocities no longer is given to be zero. So we can have the velocities are no longer just described by their divergence, and it's possible to source B-mode polarizations. So that is also an interesting direction to go in. So just to sort of sum up the key ideas that I have wanted to convey through the talk, there are assumptions that are part of our theoretical frameworks, which we should reassess if needed. And I've given two examples of assumptions that are made, which are really just that, they're assumptions. They're not even really approximations in a sense. So yeah, the two examples that I talked about. Secondly, these assumptions are not necessarily even unique choices we can have a few other options. For example, if it wasn't for the mathematical simplicity of Maxwell-Boltzmann, we could very well just have picked Fokker-Planck, or diffusive scattering. There's no other preference. Like, it's the math that has been sort of the main reason for assuming Maxwell-Boltzmann. And in fact, now we know that with the analysis that I did, we should actually be preferring Fokker-Planck because it captures the physics better. And secondly, with the mean field ansatz, we could just as reasonably, instead of picking what Dworkin et al. Did, where they average over the v squared terms inside the gamma, we could have picked the average of gamma itself. That would have also done pretty much the same, like it would have achieved the same goals. But now we are able to see that they actually picked the correct, exactly the right form. And lastly, doing this kind of reassessment can really clarify future directions in the sense that now we have a way forward with the Fokker-Planck formalism to try and incorporate dark matter self-scattering, for example, alongside dark matter baryon scattering. And now we know that we really need a different kind of approach to handle fractions of dark matter that interact with baryons at less than 100%. And we can try and probe higher order statistics because this nonlinearity problem is still there, even though now we have this first order exact contribution. The exact transfer functions are still nonlinear. Thank you for listening. That is the end of my talk. And I'm happy to take questions.
So you showed how the Fokker-Planck versus Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution assumptions change the sort of error in your heat transfer rate from a more exact simulation. Do you have a sense of how that changes sort of the cross-sectional constraints we will derive previously? Is it basically linear correction in that heat transfer gives you a linear correction in the cross-sectional constraint?
Yeah, so that's a great point. What we really do right now care about are the constraints. Like, how does this change? If it changes the constraints by too little, it's not really important. So the short answer to that I would give, and less satisfactory one, is that there isn't a direct way to transfer over, seeing that we have this really big improvement in 1D or in the background. Does that really give the same kind of improvement in 3D? But we do expect the improvement to transfer over, like because the Fokker-Planck formalism is giving us these, it's doing things that are more self-consistent than the plain Maxwell-Boltzmann assumption. The longer and hopefully more satisfactory answer that I would give is that rather than thinking about the improvement in terms of how it would change the current constraints, I would think about it as an improved way of modeling the physics better. So it gives us consistent rates. It's also less model dependent. The accuracy is less model dependent in the sense that it mainly seems to depend on the mass ratio. And even in mass regimes where it's non-diffusive, we seem to be doing pretty all right. And lastly, it opens up ways for us to then create a framework for dark matter self-scattering alongside dark matter baryon scattering. So if you have theories where you would like to take into account these kinds of things, the Fokker-Planck method would do better. But the overall, I guess, takeaway would be that with Maxwell-Boltzmann, we can still be sure, pretty much sure, within like a factor of two. So it's not like we're out of the ballpark, but it depends on what kind of precision you're going for, in a way.
So yeah. I think if I missed something there, then what's the obstacle to mapping this new method onto the constraints on the cross-section?
So this method, the analysis that I have done works in the background. The background scenario, so it effectively makes the problem a 1D Boltzmann equation kind of problem. But once we start to think about perturbations, we really need to implement the full collision operator in 3D. And that becomes quite complicated to do, to consider the change in velocities along three dimensions at all times, so evolving. In that way becomes pretty complicated. So it sort of, there's no like one-to-one mapping that sort of goes from the background to the perturbations. Yeah.
First word, thanks for
kind of sounded like there's some sort of leading order approximation, and I was wondering if there's like a systematic way to start including like say the next sub that something you did
tell me if I'm so you're saying like taking into account the term that goes as sigma squared or no I didn't understand your question properly. I haven't thought about that, I might, if we can chat offline maybe, so I can understand the question better maybe, and I can tell you, yeah, sorry about that.
I have one question about that, what you were saying, the fraction of dark matter that interacts and the non-linearity in this.
Yes. Yeah, this plot, or it's giving me the wheel right now. sorry, I'm not sure what's happening. But maybe you can tell me your question in the meantime.
I was confused. So you were saying that one is above one is where you expect linear.
No, at one.
At one,
yeah. The CLs become more and more nonlinear in sigma. The delta CL, the change in CL that is induced by scattering.
Because you were taking the fraction of dark matter interacts would be smaller, you were getting more
linearity. Yeah. So that is because we're considering the 95% upper limit that we get from the cross section. So you sort of see that in here as well, in the sense that when you're at very high fractions of interacting dark matter, the data excludes very strong interaction. And that's because you can't change the CNB anisotropies by too much if you have all of the dark matter interacting with baryons. But as you go to lower and lower fraction, you have less and less of the dark matter having this kind of effect. So that piece of the dark matter can still interact more and more strongly and still be within the limits of the data. So that's why in that other plot, when you go to lower and lower fractions, we're using these 95% limits, which are larger and larger. So the behavior in delta CLs becomes more and more nonlinear. So the fraction is, let's see. You can have nonlinear effects. So the way I guess I'm thinking about it, and maybe it's not going to really address your question, but the equations sort of get divided up into the equation that is dealing with interacting dark matter and the equation that is dealing with cold dark matter, and you can have nonlinear effects in sigma in that part of the dark matter, but not like the other piece still evolves pretty much the same. But
the bound is nonlinear with the fracture, right? So the bound dies in this subject. So when the bound dies, then you would take the cross-section as much as you want, keeping the fraction of the dark matter fixed, and then at some point you have to go nonlinear.
Okay, so there's no more questions. I was thankful for
Thank you.